Right now, our next speaker is Anne Banks, who is a writer living in New York City, and she's going to tell us something about folklore collecting as set forth by Benjamin Botkin.
Well, not to be outdone by Stetson and Allen, I'd like to say that I, too, am a Florida native, practically second generation, if such a thing can even be thought to exist, in fact. And I also went to the University of Florida in Gainesville, and I found it just about the same in the early 60s as Stetson found it in the 30s. So maybe it's changed now. Anyway. Today, I'm really not going to talk about Florida. I'm going to talk about some of the same things, but from a broader national and more administrative perspective. And I'd like to say I'm going to be talking about people and events that I know only from research. Others in this room know these things firsthand, and they are, in fact, some of the people. So if I get this wrong, you'll just have to bear with me and wait till the question period to challenge it. Imagine, if you will, a warm spring evening in 1939. We are on the front porch of the Odd Fellows Retirement Home in Portland, Oregon, far from Florida. An old man named Hank Sims is sitting in a rocking chair, reminiscing about his mining days. A young man seated beside him is taking notes. Here's part of what Sims had to say. When I talk, I'm liable to do some tall running off at the mouth. I'm a miner, and for 40, 50 years, I've been tunneling a shaft straight into this poorhouse. You can't call that very good mining. I'm a hard rock man, and I learned my business up in the Feather River country. That was a big digging, and some of the best of the old hands was there. A man had to know his business, and a foreman could tell a greenhorn like reading beef from a poor ox. No one ever got fired in them days. All you had to do was criticize a man, and he'd quit. There was none of this sucking around like you have now, and a man didn't hang on to his job like a priest to a parish. Every once in a while, we just drug down our pay on principle and went down the road to a new job. They'd call us hobos now, I guess. But in them days, we was known as Overland Johns, and by God, I knew every creek and cow between here and Mexico and right back up to Alaska. Every now and then, the young man, whose name was Walker Winslow, would break into Sims' monologue with a question. But Sims didn't like being interrupted. When he was asked about gold miners' lingo, he told Winslow, "You'll just have to pan it out of my talk." The reason this exchange took place 50 years ago, and of course the reason we know about it today, is because of the Federal Writers Project. And like Stetson, Walker Winslow was one of the 6,000 or so young writers and would-be writers who went to work for the WPA, the New Deal Work Relief Program. And in their early years, as I'm sure everyone knows, the project produced a series of state and local guidebooks which were published, many of which have been reissued lately to great success. But the federal writers went on to gather the largest body of first-person narratives ever collected in this country. The interview methods encouraged people to talk freely, quote, following the natural associations of ideas and memories. Ideally, the life histories were to capture, quote, all the flavor of talk and all the native art of casual narration belonging to the natural storyteller. Thank you. The author of these instructions was a man named Benjamin Botkin, who was folklore editor of the project when most of the first-person narratives were collected. His views and interests were the ones that set the tone. By the time he joined the project in 1938, Botkin had developed his own unconventional approach to the subject of folklore. He had little interest in indulging the nostalgia for the old, the odd, and the picturesque, as he termed it. Instead, he wanted the folklore unit to explore the rough texture of everyday life, to collect what he called living lore. Now, these narratives were always intended to be published in a series of anthologies that would form a composite portrait of America through the storytelling of people from various occupations, regions, and ethnic groups. This work was meant to instruct as well as describe, because in the late 1930s, Botkin and his associates on the project, of course, along with many other Americans, were horrified by the rise of fascism in Europe, and they worried about possible consequences at home. So Botkin and some of his associates came to believe that the work of the folklore unit could help foster tolerance by reinforcing a vision of America as a democratic, pluralistic community composed of many disparate elements. I think it's very interesting to keep this particular agenda in mind when you're reading some of the material that was collected. But by the late Depression, the Federal Writers Project, along with the other federal arts projects, had become a tempting target for the House Un-American Activities Committee. And after a period of red baiting, Congress allowed the arts projects to die a slow death, and the plans for the series of anthologies were scratched. So there was a vast store of unpublished material that remained the hidden legacy of the Federal Writers Project, and one that's now beginning to come more and more to light. The voices set down by the project were nearly as diverse as the American population itself. And when I went through 150,000 or so pages of material, which were then stored in an obscure room of the Library of Congress called the Buzzard's Nest. Now they're in the manuscript room under very proper controls, but not at that time. I found that the file drawers were filled to bursting with people who had interesting stories to tell. And it was really quite an experience. Usually I was the only person in this room with kind of a few lights and just this dust and plaster falling down and just these file drawers, and what kind of came to life out of the drawers was quite miraculous. One interesting thing I noticed is that most of the people never mentioned the Depression. Hard times was most all they'd ever seen, and to them the Great Depression was just another bump in the road. Instead, they often focused on the everyday round of work and play, the details of survival. The narratives are full of knowing advice: how to get a job at Macy's, when it's safe to wear a union button, how to outsmart a tyrannical father or a dim-witted beau. And of course, in the 30s, the 19th century was as recent as the Depression is for us today. I found a story of one pioneer woman who claimed to have known Billy the Kid. Not really a bad fellow at all, she said. There was the retired dry goods sales peddler who'd seen the Chicago fire of 1871 with his own eyes. Other stories seemed amazingly contemporary. There were Chicago jazz musicians who talked about smoking marijuana, a substance they referred to as muggles. An elderly Irish housemaid in Boston explained how employers used to test the servants' honesty by leaving a $5 bill out as bait. A Bahamian midwife from Riviera, Florida, explained that her best remedy was a tea made from mud daubers' nests. A Key West rum runner told Stetson that he'd been Ernest Hemingway's principal informant for to have and have not, and Stetson believed him. In Harlem, an off-duty Pullman porter talked to federal writer Ralph Ellison in Eddie's Bar on St. Nicholas Avenue. "I'm in New York, but New York ain't in me," he said. And later that line turned up in Ellison's great novel, Invisible Man. For aspiring writers such as Ellison and Kennedy, the project offered much more than just a meal ticket. Botkin considered it, quote, the greatest educational as well as social experiment of our time. And he believed that collecting the stories of ordinary people could give federal writers a social consciousness that usually was lacking in what he disparagingly termed ivory tower writing, by which I suppose he meant writing that came out of universities. Botkin was a supporter of the movement to literary realism that was popular in the 30s. And in the tradition that Alan DeBoer just described, he wanted to bring, quote, the streets, the stockyards, and the hiring halls into literature. He saw the oral history interviews as raw material for fiction, the stuff of literature, he called them. And so they became. Nelson Algren wrote a novel about seamy aspects of Chicago life called A Walk on the Wild Side, passages of which echo the Federal Writers Project interview that he did with a Chicago prostitute. A according to Ralph Ellison, collecting folklore in the project threw me into my own history. And once you've touched the history of blacks in New York, you were deep into American history. And then a story that Stetson heard about a gruesome Ku Klux Klan murder later inspired him to infiltrate the Klan, an experience he wrote about in his book, I Rode with the Ku Klux Klan. Federal writers learned from the content of the stories they collected, but they also learned from practicing the technique of collecting them. I was going to talk a bit more about methodology, but it really Stetson covered a lot of that. But I just wanted to say that one of Bette Botkin's major points was to stress the importance of the process of collecting the narratives. He wrote that the best results were obtained when a good informant and a good interviewer get together, and the narrative is a product of the conscious or unconscious collaboration between the two. He specifically instructed federal writers to make your subject feel important. Well-conducted interviews, he wrote, serve as social occasions to which informants come to look forward. Now, naturally, such advice was interpreted differently according to the temperament and inclinations of individual field workers, as I discovered in conversations with several former federal writers. Stetson told me that he established a comfortable atmosphere by interviewing people in their homes over a glass of beer. Before tackling anything as personal as a life history, he said, we naturally established a great deal of rapport with the person before telling them their lives were so interesting they should be written down. Most people agreed, and the more notes you took, the better they liked it. This is an interesting point to me because I think that people often feel that your informant is going to be self-conscious, and so you should pretend that you're not really doing what you're doing. And I find, as Stetson said, just the opposite. And also, I've watched Studs Terkel work, and he, in fact, also plays back and has the person hear what they're saying and kind of invites them into the collaboration to create together this document. Frank Bird, who was a black federal writer, did some wonderful interviews in Harlem, became good friends with several of the residents he interviewed. And as he reminded me, he said, at that time, anyone would talk to you because we didn't have much else to do but drink and talk and sit around. Nobody was wary of talking to me. I was just another partygoer as far as they were concerned. Of course, you can't just barge in and start asking questions of people. You have to pass the time of day with them until you reach the point where you feel a warm relationship so they can talk and so you can talk. The federal writers pioneered the collection of first-person narratives by people who would not otherwise have left a record. At least that is true in this country. There were precedents of Henry Mayhew in England and other places. But Botkin called for an emphasis on what he termed history from the bottom up. I'm not sure that he originated that phrase, but I believe that he probably did, and it certainly has become amazingly current in the years since then, in which people become their own historians. And he believed the quote, history must study the inarticulate many as well as the articulate few. In this view, although this view has become quite popular among historians in the past decade or so, and the advent of tape recorders has refined this practice of oral history and made it possible for these goals to be pursued more easily. But Botkin also believed that it wasn't enough to collect first-person narratives solely as archival source material for scholars. They should be available, he said, to an ever-widening public. For the men and women who told their stories to the federal writers did so in the hopes that their voice might be heard by an audience beyond their immediate circle of family and friends, and that their lives would touch people they had never met. The narratives transcend their function as, quote, evidence, historical or social. We see instead clear portraits of individuals who reveal in their words the richness and character of their lives. Now, I would like to play some excerpts from the interviews, since they were collected without tape recorders or wire recorders. These were done by actors for a radio series based on some of the interviews. And so the first person whose words you'll hear dramatized is Elizabeth Miller, a Vermont farm wife who was 90 at the time she was interviewed. And she tells the story of an important moment of triumph in her life that had happened some 60 years earlier.
Is nothing but changes. We never used to can things the way we do now. We salted pork down, froze the beef, packed it in oats, and had the root crops in the cellar. One fall, we had a 550-pound dressed hog hanging in the yard. The man went off to Wells River to take up another hog they'd dressed at the same time and left it hanging there, and the cauldron kettle half full of water. They aimed to get back and take the hog down cellar before it froze. It would never do to let pork that was going to be salted freeze. I was all alone with the children, and I waited until almost 12. My husband didn't come, so I took a lantern and a saw and a knife and went out to fetch in that hog. I emptied out the water from the cauldron kettle so it wouldn't freeze and burst. Then I cut up that hog and loaded it piecemeal onto the sled. The worst part was getting it through the front door, but I managed. I had it all done before my husband got home. He asked who had brought the hog in. I did, I said. He asked who helped, and I said, alone. I wasn't wasting many words on him. He was struck dumb.
That's wonderful. I like to think that's just about how it sounded. The next story is a man named Lloyd Green. He was the Pullman porter I mentioned, just off work, who was sitting in a bar on St. Nicholas Avenue, who talked to Ralph Ellison about the hard times of adjusting to city life. He'd come up from the South.
Take Lennox Avenue. Take 7th Avenue. Hell, take Sugar Hill. Pimps, numbers, teaching these poor people out of what they got. Shooting, cutting, backbiting, all them things. You see? You see what I mean? I'm in New York, but New York ain't in me. Don't laugh. No, I'm laughing, but I don't mean it. No, it ain't funny. You see, I'm on Sugar Hill, but Sugar Hill ain't on me. I come here 25 years ago. Bright light, pretty women, more space to move around in, you know. Son, if I had got New York and me, I'd have been dead long time ago. What happened the other night? You heard about that shooting up here in the hill here? Now you take that boy. I know him. Anybody been riding this hill knows him. And they know he went to a bad man. Now, what'd he do? Now, mind you, now, his brother's a big shot. Makes plenty of money. Got a big car, fine office. But he comes up on this hill tearing up people's property if they don't pay him protection. Last night, he walks up to this Watts place up the street here and tries to tear it up. Now, you know that's a bad man. You gonna tear up the Watts place, see? Well, you stepped out the door there and a bunch of them Watts showed up in the car and tried to blow his head off. Yeah, he had too much New York. You see, I'm in New York, as I see. But New York ain't in me. Hell yeah, he went and got too much New York. You understand what I'm trying to tell you now?
The next woman is Anna Novak, a packing house worker. She told her story to federal writers just as the CIO union came to the stockyards, and she describes an industrial accident that wasn't unusual in the late 1930s because the meatpacking industry had the highest accident rate among consumer industries. And by the way, I've met her. She's under a different name, lives in Chicago today. It was wonderful to find not just that some of the federal writers, but I also found about maybe half a dozen of the informants who were still alive, and that was an incredible experience.
Was those working nights? and it was 1 minute to 11. We were supposed to start at 11. The girl next to me was waiting, and she had her thumb in the dry cornmeal machine bin, picking at something. At the other end of the room was the girl who turned on the machinery switch when it was time to start. Well, that lousy foreman thought he'd rush work. So we come up to the machine starter and hollered, "All right, shake your fannies, it's 11 o'clock. She pressed the switch, and this other girl at the end of the room screamed. Her thumb was cut clean off. Because of a man so eager to push company production that safety restrictions meant nothing to him if he could chisel even a minute of the girl's time without having to pay for it. It's things like that the union's here to prevent, and to see that when some worker does meet such an accident, she won't be thrown out on the dump heap. Every dog gets his day, and when I get mine," and we just laugh and say, "Oh, the dogs have their day now. You had yours 10 years ago before the union came." Does he get sore?
Does anybody recognize the actress? It's Estelle Parsons. Let's see. The next story is taken from one of the many life histories that were collected in Barrie, Vermont, with men who worked in the granite industry. Many of the granite carvers were immigrants from Italy, and they considered themselves artisans, but often they died young of silicosis from years of breathing air misty with stone dust. Anthony Tonelli describes life in the granite sheds in Barrie, which are still there, by the way.
And I say, the silicosis problem going to be solved.
Silicosis.
I'm going to tell you what. Modern machinery, that's going to do it. They're going to fix it up. Too late for me, but just the same. I have seen big, strong, healthy men come to work. They have laughing eyes. They show their love life. They enjoy themselves. They're good worker. They have strength and the knowledge of the job, skill. And they don't last long. The big, strong men do not last long against the stone dust. They die, and the people cry, and the family starve for a while. But all the time I keep saying that this dust is going to end in the sheds. And they say, "You're a fool. The dust is going to be here forever." No, they're right. I'm not too smart. But I think a lot. I see improvement in every line. I say the scientists, they're brilliant. They study when we're not even thinking about it. They cure a disease and want to kill millions. They make automobiles. They get better every year. Look at the children. They get better care. The doctors, they know more about it. Why wouldn't they end the big problem of ours? You will see men work along in the sheds. They will not grow old so fast. I have gone to work in the morning, and after a little while in the shed, I don't recognize my own body. I was covered from head to foot with the dust. And we have to breathe the dust in. That's what does it. We give our all strength, our hearing, our hands, our sight, the eyes, everything we possess. And then what do we get out of it? Just a little money. Granite cutter have always been underpaid. You can't get around it. You go in there and you're going to die young. I am a letterer. I have a big responsibility. If I cut one little piece from a stone, just when it is nearing completion, that spoiled the whole works. Is it all destroyed? Then I get the gate. So I can't take any chances. I can't get drunk with all that at stake. Takes everything I got, everything, even my life. After a day in the sheds, I'm no good for nothing, then nobody. How many men can stand it? By the time you become good at your trade, you're ready to die.
The next interview is with a man named Jack Hartley, who was interviewed in an Oklahoma City oil field. He was a roustabout, or common laborer, who followed the oil boom from town to town.
Okay.
When I first came to New York from Bermuda, I thought red parties were just crazy.
Sorry, that's not Jack Hartley. I forgot about Bernice Gore, who was talking about rent parties in Harlem in the late 1920s. And these parties were an answer to the outrageously high rents and low wages that blacks faced when they arrived in New York City. So around the time the rent was due, neighbors were invited to a get-together with music, food, corn liquor. But Bernice herself tells it very well.
When I first came to New York from Bermuda, I thought rent parties were just graceful. I couldn't understand how any self-respecting person could bear them. But my husband, who was a Pullman porter, ran off and left me with a $60 a month apartment on my hands and no job. I soon learned, like everyone else, to rent my rooms out and throw those Saturday get-togethers. I had two rooms, a colored boy and a white girl named Leroy and Hazel, first gave me the idea. They offered to run the parties for me if we'd split 50-50. And I had nothing to lose, so that's how we started. We bought corn liquor by the gallon and sold it for 50 cents a small pitcher. And Leroy ran a poker and blackjack game in the little bedroom off the kitchen. On those two games alone, I've seen him take in as much as $28 in one night, honey. Well, you can see, I didn't want to give it up once we had started, especially since I could only make $6 or $7 at most as a part-time domestic. The game paid us both so well. Fact is, we soon made gambling our specialty. Everybody liked it, and our profits were more that way, so our place soon became the hangout of all those partygoers who liked to mix a little gambling with their drinking and dancing. And with all these young studs with plenty of cash in their pockets out to find a little mischief, we soon learned not to leave things to chance. Instead, Hazel and I would go out and get acquainted with good-looking young fellas sitting alone in the back of gin mills looking so sad and nobody to take them out. We'd give them our cards and tell them to drop around to the house. Well, wherever there are pretty women, you'll soon have a pack of men, honey.
Next, we're going to have Jack Hartley.
A driller makes damn good money when he works, but he don't work every day. I work 5 days a week for Barnstable, and I get $140 a month. Now, that ain't very much, but it's steady. My company's moving out of this Oklahoma City field. It's about played out, and they don't figure this stuff will last more than 9 months. There ain't enough gas pressure left now to blow your hat off. I kind of hate to leave Oklahoma City, though, because of the accommodations around here. It's easy to find a place to stay, a good place, too. And the rent's cheap as it can be when you compare it with them Texas towns. I don't guess me and my wife ever lived in a regular house till we moved here to Oklahoma City. We just kind of jungled up wherever we could and tried to live through it. And when that boom was over, we went through the same kind of a deal again. My oldest daughter was born in a shack tent in Osage County. We had an old tent I bought in town, and that was all I could buy. My wife don't like me to tell things like that. She says, people think we've been living like a pack of dogs or something. But I tell her, hell, Francis, that's the way we did live, and why not tell her?
Just two more. The next is Manuel Captiva, who was a fisherman in Cape Cod who immigrated from the Azores Islands.
Anybody will tell you there ain't no man can fish better than the Portuguese. We can always get jobs on the boats. I would not want to work on land all the time. I would never be happy unless I had a boat under me. I ain't a good fisherman. Maybe I wouldn't do so good with a regular land job. The Yankees fish to get money enough to run shops, maybe, or do business. The Portuguese fish because he wants to, because he doesn't want no boss. One time, I had a good job on a yacht. A good pay, the best of everything, but I didn't like it. Rather be independent, not say this yes, sir, and no, sir, all the time. The Yankees, they don't mind. They run stores, they work for bosses, they don't care. The Portuguese aren't as good for business, but we made the cape. We built it up. Us and the American fishermen. We made Gloucester too. We are the Portuguese pilgrims. When we first come here, there was nothing but sand and a few houses and docks and boats. We used to drive codfish out on the dunes. They'd be pretty near miles spread out, the whole place stink. There was fishermen all up and down the Cape then. The old whalers, one of them. Fishing off the Grand Banks was gold mine. You'd get so much couldn't load at all. Sometimes you'd be out 2-3 nights cleaning up to your knees in it and half frozen. Then the artists come down. They must have painted 100 miles of nets and boats and docks. And then the writers heard about it, and the summer people. But we started it.
I'm out of time, but I just want you to hear this last story. It's some man who was interviewed by Ralph Ellison named Eli Lester, who was a street corner orator in Harlem.
Let's see now. This is 1939. For 1900 years, man's had things his way. He's been running the world to suit himself. Rich folks done took all the land. They got all the money. Men down to the city hall making $50,000 a year, and nothing like this can't even scrub the marble floors or polish the brass what they got down there. But you just watch. The Lord made all men equal, and pretty soon now it's going to be that way again. God don't know no color. All he want from man is this heart thumping the blood. Them would take advantage of skin like this got to come by God. They're going to pay. Won't be no old man Rockefeller, no son. Won't be nothing like that then. He'll let loose and something will slip down here, and then what done took advantage of everything will be floating down the river. The Lord's going to have his day. There'll be a war. But it won't be no more wars like the world war. It won't bother me and you. Won't really be no war. It'll be the wicked killing the wicked. They building navies and buying guns. But don't you worry. It'll be just the wicked killing out the wicked. It's coming. God's time is coming. And it's coming soon.
On that note.
All right. Words to ponder. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne.